Well, today we are going to talk about one of the mysteries of eternity. A problem that every human being has faced and must face in the course of his existence. And it is interesting to realize that there are a number of remarkable interpretations of this phenomenon, which we call death. So in many cases, the idea has been that the afterlife was simply an extension of physical existence into an invisible realm. This was the idea of the Chinese emperor, who had clay copies of his court made in life-size figures, standing in rows to serve him in the afterlife. Now, he did not believe that those concrete figures were going to serve him, but he believed in a spiritual mystery involved, that after he passed into the other world, these concrete and stone figures would be living, that they would be alive and full size and would serve him, and that he was merely moving his court from the visible to the invisible side of life. Now, in Egypt, a similar practice was also followed, but with more symbolism involved. The afterlife of the Egyptian, the Elysian Fields, or the plains of Amentet, were a beautiful facsimile of Egypt. The same grounds with the same beautiful river, the wonderful people, the palaces, the temples, and all the makeup of a tremendous metropolitan Egyptian super city. At that time also, the pharaoh was buried, and other nobles with similar expositions. He was buried with miniature figures of all of his retinue, his court, and all of the valuable things that he needed to continue his life in the tomb. The afterlife of the Egyptian was in an underworld, ruled over by the great deity Osiris. And this great deity, judging the quick and the dead, ruled over a wonderful realm beneath the earth that men could not see, but to which human beings passed after the physical decease. In some of the old manuscripts, various animals, such as family pets, were included among the figures that came with him into the afterlife. Everywhere we find evidences of the belief that the invisible world to which we pass and from which we came has a more or less physical appearance that it is similar to the world that we know. It was not until comparatively late in the development of human thinking that the idea of heaven and hell as we think of it today came into existence. Most of antiquity had really no concept of hell. They did not have any of that Dante-esque mystery that we find in the beautiful but morbid paintings of Gustave Doré. To the ancient people, hell was more or less of a shadow. They did not believe they were bad enough to deserve it in the first place, and they were perfectly willing to face a world that went on into a realm beyond ours. The Greeks, for many centuries, believed that there was no afterlife except in the ghost world. The ghosts of the dead continued forever. This did not meet with the approval of minds such as Pythagoras and Plato and Aristotle, and modification began at a comparatively early date. Among the Egyptians and Phoenicians, the invisible world was so visible and so real that you continued in your various pursuits as you had lived them in life. If you had plowed a field while alive, you would have a field to plow in the afterlife. And there is one story about a very honest moneylender who had never cheated those who borrowed from him. He was a very good man. So when he died, they gave him a special privilege in the afterlife. He could set up his money tables by the gates of heaven and lend money to anyone coming in who wanted it. And he always was meticulous and honest. And it was the honesty, and not his profession, that earned him this respect. Then we have another group of people who believe, as many primitive people do, including a number on the Western Hemisphere, that death is a birth into the afterlife. And many ancient peoples buried the dead in embryo position, so that the earth became the womb of the second birth. We find tombs of this kind on all the continents. We also have evidences that many of those who lived before us, at least, had a consciousness of being able to travel in the afterlife while they still lived. This is true of the American Indians of the Southwest. It was also true of the Irish. The Irish perfectly believed that certain of their sages and saints could go into the afterlife, and that they would be welcomed there, and they could bring back messages for those who needed guidance or assistance. It was not until comparatively late that the death took on the terrible appearance with which we have associated with. It was not regarded by the ancients as a misfortune. It was regarded as a simple transference of conditions. The individual did not change greatly by the transition, but he functioned in a different dimension of life. And here he had to grow and learn and grow up again and go to school in some way to learn his way around this new realm. Now, psychics in all parts of the world have given us traditions about this. Andrew Jackson Davis, the seer of Poughkeepsie, one of America's most prominent early spiritualists, gave what he called a picture, the Summerland. This Summerland was a beautiful countryside, and it was an invisible pasture field with flowers and trees where individuals lived out a very beautiful life if they had earned such a record. If they had made some mistakes and so forth, they received some punishments, but ultimately were accepted into the world of eternal light, eternal sun and summer, eternal happiness. So this was one psychic belief, and he wrote the book, The Stellar Key to the Summerland. Another psychic of great fame was Baron Emanuel Swedenborg, who was one of the greatest scientists of the Scandinavian countries. He was also in his later years a psychic and had many beliefs concerning the conditions of the afterlife. He left very detailed accounts of conditions beyond the grave, which very well resembled conditions in a well-run Swedish state. And among other things, in Swedenborg's viewpoint, any young ladies who happened to arrive in this afterworld were chaperoned to make sure that everything retained its proper proprieties. Now, we have constantly had psychics who have something to say about this type of thing, but have been strangely uncertain themselves. We very seldom have a psychic exposition in which the emphasis is how things are over there. We hear about famous people coming back to converse with the living, but it does not seem that any answers that they give clear the problem of life after death. The answers accept the problem, but they do not clear the path or the way or the circumstances involved in the transition. This seems to have been generally neglected throughout almost all psychic experiences. Jacob Böhme, the German mystic, had visions of the afterlife. His visions of this were very much based upon the visions of Dionysius Areopagus, the early Christian father. These dreams and visions represented a luminous universe with hierarchies representing the planets and the zodiacs. This luminous world was a world of light, of color, vibration, and was a very pleasant place. But what you do when you get there, Bamy didn't tell us. All he expressed was the fact that it was a vision of things to be, such as the visions of the Gnostics and the Albigensians and the Manicheans and many others. Each religion of the world has its own concept of paradise, where it is and what it is. There seems to be very little, however, detailed study of the subject. Now, let's go back to our own problem here. Supposing we assume for a moment at least that this world that we live in now can be considered as a basic example of something, an example that it is hard to deny, an example which might tell us a lot if we consider it carefully. We know that life here begins with pain, begins with trouble, that most existence that we have here passes through stages of troubles and infirmities, that it only lasts for a certain length of time, and then in one way or another we depart. But there are a lot of things to think about in this. Why is this world, which was given to us according to Scripture as a garden, why did it get to be so troubled? Why is this planet that presumably was invented, devised, or created for the purpose of allowing or enabling human souls to grow? Why has it been in trouble since the very beginning? Why has this growth consisted principally of war and crime? Why does everyone who comes into this world apparently come into a sphere of sickness, disease, sorrow, and death? Is this part of a plan, or is this something that shouldn't be but got to be from other causes? Let us assume for a moment that the person living in this world is living in a highly conditioned condition, which he has probably, in one way or another, caused for himself. In other words, it was not intended that birth should be a problem of great pain, that the growing up and living through the various intensities of life would be an endless cause of suffering and mental anguish, or that sickness would dominate the careers of many, and that very often both birth and death were painful experiences. Is this due to the fact that such was nature's intent? Or is it due to the fact that humanity, in one way or another, has tried to take over nature, has tried to rule nature rather than obey it, has tried to create its own laws, and has set up a human autocracy in the midst of a divine one? It seems as though there is much to indicate that the troubles that we have are mostly not the result of the way nature put things together, but the way that we have readjusted and dodged them from one condition to another. We have juggled these factors, and we have mixed them up so badly that we have ended up with crime and war. Suppose, for example, the human being had not made these mistakes. Supposing he had obeyed the laws of life as they were given to him and revealed again and again through his sacred writings and the wisdom of his sages. We would say the human being was born in peace and in consolation. That there was no back heredity, there were no deformities, there was no hereditary sickness, disease, emotional incompatibilities, broken homes from which the individual had to come. Suppose that was eliminated. The result would be a very different type of person. A person not necessarily wise, but a person endowed with the natural gift of the world in which he lives. He would be endowed with the simple fact that he could exist, happily and comfortably, and for the most part, in good health. Now, most of our problems probably arise basically from bad health. We become toxic or disturbed emotionally. We gain all kinds of problems which we assemble and struggle with, And we find that this span of 60, 70, 80, 90 years through which we passed is largely a confusion caused by ourselves. And two aspects of that confusion that come into focus with us at the moment are, due to this confusion, birth is painful. And due to this same condition, death is painful. Now, it's not necessarily true that that was what was intended, but that is what we have done about it. We have taken natural laws and so misused them, distorted them, and ignored them, that we have brought down upon ourselves a mass of troubles which were not necessary and which were not intended by nature. Nature did not intend man to come into a world of miseries, suffer, and depart in pain. These conditions are due to human action and thought. We are now fighting in our communities a whole series of such problems. We are fighting narcotics addiction, alcoholism, tobacco addiction. We are fighting all kinds of laws and rules relating to wealth, power, and ambition. We have set all of our goals on the physical plane of life. We have taken this world, which might have been a very happy playground, and turned it into an infirmary and a vast graveyard. This is not what nature intended. This is not what man was put together for. This is not the experience he was supposed to be ready to receive. It was assumed that he would come to this world to gradually come to glorify the Creator and the creation. Instead of that, he has come in the end to damn them both. So we have here a false beginning. And with a false beginning, we also have to go back a ways, because this false winning is of the sins of the fathers unto the fifth and sixth generation. We are all here with infirmities that have come from the misdeeds of our ancestors. And these we carefully pass on to our descendants. The result is that health is almost imaginary, but we are beginning to realize more of its importance. And in the last 50 years, we have done more thinking about health, probably, than any time in history. We may almost say that primitive mankind didn't think about it because it didn't do anything to hurt itself, primarily. It lived a very simple life. It had to defend itself against the terrors of the night and things of this nature, but for the most part, it lived a very simple existence. As we came to be more and more complicated, we became sicker and sicker. We gradually also then developed institutions to correct these sicknesses that we had created. But because we created them within ourselves and not in the body, the physician is not always successful. We are not able to cure the sins of the spirits with pills and shots. The entire part of the individual that is important to us at the moment is that which we can't see. It is the invisible over-self that really runs the physical body. This over-self, however, is so neglected by most people that the body is without adequate leadership. It is as though a very nice government were set up with a proper representative, and in the course of time, a bunch of gangsters took it over. And these gangsters are our selfishness and our deceits and our stupidity and our rejection of common sense. All these together have ruined what might have been a pretty good place to live. Now, we're gradually beginning to be a little more aware of this. It is dawning upon us that it's possible that all these misfortunes are not necessary, that they were not in the original archetype, but have been the result of vicious misinterpretation or distortion of the common facts of good nature and common sense. So we say to ourselves, suppose we clean this up. We might then have a world in which the human being would be decently born, with comparatively little pain to the parent, a world in which they would grow up gradually, and education would be suitable and adequate to their needs, and not to try to adjust them to a hopeless situation. We are educated more or less to try and lengthen our survival in a situation that never should have existed in the first place. A true education, a true realization of our real purpose and our real potential, hasn't a chance. It wouldn't even be mentioned because it would interfere with some monopoly that is flourishing, for the moment at least. So we have no way of, at the moment, correcting some of these problems. But they are correctable. They should never have existed. And they represent a very vicious misuse of an inheritance which came from the highest possible source, truth. So we go along through the years and we get sick. And we get tired. And we get tempted. And one by one we fall under some form of disease or displeasure which begins to corrupt our natures. And so the body, which probably has a potential strength of at least close to a century, may give out any pair along the line because simply it does not have the strength with which it was intended to be endowed. Now, this doesn't mean that every person in trouble has lived a riotous life. But behind every person may be several generations of the lawless. And many a proud family now, which is also in trouble, it has among its ancestors two or three that were hung from the yardarm. They were actually pirates of the worst. So we have bring with us a body which is more or less not a blessed gift in the beginning, the way it is now, though the best can be done under the circumstances. But this body comes in with a great many deficiencies that are due to the ancestral pattern and the whole line of the descent of humanity. The human generation regeneration problem has been going on for ages. And we are now well along in a platform of misunderstandings and ignorance. So we come here with what we have. And being not too well, we begin to look over the situation to see if we can find something to do about it. So we get a little help from some new kinds of people that come up who are beginning to teach the importance of nature in remedying the defects of human beings. We begin to think of exercise and diet and living a little cleaner life and refraining from some of the noxious and toxic situations that are now gaining fame and distinction. But the moment we try to improve, we hit upon some pattern where someone is making a good profit by our not improving, and then we have difficulties again. In other words, to become honest is desperately dangerous. It becomes an interference with the rights of other people to do to us anything they feel like doing, which may or may not be particularly constructive. So on we go, and we learn a little as we go along, and we try to improve life, but we come gradually towards the end of the endurance of a body that has been seriously misused. At that time, there is a whole group of terminal illnesses with which we are combating. We are trying desperately to find cures for them, but we don't even dare to suspect that we might find a cause of them that could be corrected. So in the course of time, we come at the end, and we come to the time where there must be a division between the physical body and the metaphysical elements of the personality. We believe in idealistic philosophy and in the higher realms of thinking that the physical body is a kind of carriage, a wagon, in which something rides, that the actual being in the body is not identical with it. If you believe them to be identical, you are a materialist. If you do not believe that they are identical, you are an idealist. And 90% of humanity has been idealistic since the dawn of time. Very few peoples have ever come to maturity who believed that the individual died at the grave. Nearly everyone has had some philosophy of survival. And without this philosophy of survival, there seems to be no incentives to rise above the misfortunes of the present state. In other words, if you're miserable here, but you do the best you can, perhaps somewhere else you're going to get a better chance. Many nations have also gradually developed the concept of reincarnation as an answer to the infinite problem pattern of growth. It is perfectly obvious that the average person in one body as we see them now in incarnation cannot be perfect. We know definitely that we cannot know everything. We cannot be everything. We try to have everything, but very few make it. What we really are is growing creatures in a midstream of life. We came from something less, and we're growing into something better. And this growth, obviously, is not completed in one life. The individual who makes a modest gain must be considered a success. Those who ignore the whole thing can be rather much failures. So not being able to be perfect now, the doctrine of reincarnation comes in and is probably now accepted by something like a third of the population of the earth. It is believed because it is the most reasonable answer to a long-range plan in nature. It is also the only description or the only solution that rewards sincerity and helps the individual to outgrow his own weaknesses and infirmities. If reincarnation is a truth, then comes another question, which is related to the original one. If this is true, where is the being when it is not incarnate? The Oriental peoples take the ground that incarnations are normally and honorably about 1,000 years apart. Under certain conditions, these figures can be modified and changed, and in cases of very advanced persons, the time is shorter. This is because they are more needed here to do the things that there are not too many available to accomplish. But if we have reincarnation, where is the individual between incarnations? There have been discussions of these, and someone says they may be in Devakan or someplace in the heavenly world, or according to Ptolemy, up somewhere in the zodiac. But these are very faint and uncertain indications. There does not seem to be any real map of the life cycle other than a diagram and words. The experiences involved seem to be very hard to trace, and most even students of the subject have not been successful in creating a vivid or living image of the situation. So we have to wonder a little bit about what is the other side of this coin. Where and what are the invisible parts of nature? Flood, the Rosicrucian mystic, and several others have speculated carefully upon this, and they have followed the idea or viewpoint that man is composed of a series of bodies, that he is not just a physical body, nor is he just a physical body and a spirit. He is not a physical body and a ghost. He is a compound creature constructed internally to function in more than one dimension of space. We have one dimension here which we function with. But even when we're functioning here, there is evidence every day that there is something more than function occurring within us. The individual is more than a body. He is also more than a body and a mechanism. He is not a robot. He is more than a mechanism because he is a body with an emotional nature. He can love, he can hope, he can dream, he can have religion, he can do all kinds of emotional things which are not natural to body, nor essential to energy, but are essential to the functions that the human being possesses. Then beyond that, there is another pattern, and that is mind, the mental life of the person. His mind is not his body. You can dissect him in any way you want to, but you're never going to find the mind. You can find the brain, but not the mind. The brain has to be alive, and the mind has to be incarnate in that brain, or there is no mentality. But man has mentality. He can think. He has emotions. He can love. He has vitality. He can win at the Olympic Games. And he has physical establishment, which we call the body, which he keeps in the house and sends to work every day. These different things are part of man. They make together a person. And these four parts are all more or less vehicles, instruments to be used by something, to do something. Now, the mind is not a divine thing. It is simply a dimension of existence necessary to thinking. But thinking is not the highest faculty of man. There are all other kinds of higher faculties. And most of all, this whole chain of bodies, like beads, this chain is strung of many beads upon a single thread, as Emerson tells us, and that this thread he calls the over-self, or the soul. Now, the soul seems to be the master of the mystery. The soul seems to be that thing in man which does not limit him to any of the dimensions of his physical sensory perceptions. The soul permits him to hope and to dream. It permits him to ensoul thinking, ensoul living, ensoul emotion. Without this ensouling, these various faculties are sterile. And this is one problem that we have, where humanity spends all its time working with the bodies and forgets the soul. We have a group of sterile organisms and organizations which have no vitality, no reason for existence. Hope, ideals, and the greater, nobler emotions of religion and personal consciousness are all part of something above the mind. And this the ancients like to call the soul, which was the master of the entire cycle of human growth. Now, the soul, as Emerson tells us, is a part of divine nature. It is part of something that ensouls all things, so that we can say without exaggeration that the world is itself a soul from which a body is suspended, that this body contains of several levels of management. And various creatures have different degrees of levels. There are some creatures, like plants, who have only the growth dimension. There are others, like animals, who have the emotional development. And there's finally man, who has the mental development. But this is added to the others, making him a composite being with four levels of availability. Now, when he gets ready to be educated or think about trying to do something in life, he should realize that he has these four different levels through which he can manifest. Now, he isn't his mind, nor his body. It is an inhabitant. It is a leaser. He can't own the body, but it can lease it for life. It cannot possess anything, but it can use whatever it wills to accumulate honorably. Thus, we have the individual who at a certain time in this pattern is going to depart from this world. Now, he's going to be depart in a series of stages or steps. And this is shown in some of the mystical alchemical diagrams. The death cycle, therefore, begins with the discarding of the physical body. This physical body departs from all of the extremities of the body and finally centers in the heart. From the heart, it carries upward along the pneumogastric nerve until it reaches the crown of the head. And at the crown of the head, it departs. And it takes with it for a time a magnetic connection between the super self or the real self and the body, a cord which ties them together. This is an umbilical cord for the afterlife, just as it was necessary to have it for the child before birth, so afterwards this cord connects the entity with the body, so that if shock or something of a special nature, suspended animation, should occur, death would not follow unless the cord breaks. And this is the cord that is broken at the cistern in the Bible. But anyway, this cord ties the being to the body. When this is broken, the being is in the land of energies. It's in its next body, superior to the physical one. Here it is in a world of energies. In these energies, also, it passes through a series of experiences. The vital or energy body resembles very closely the physical, and is therefore subject to all the rules that govern physical body, but invisibly. After a certain length of time in which the consciousness extracts from the body the records of an embodiment in order to estimate growth and to guide in the larger directive of the complete composite, this body of shadows or vital energies is discarded also. As it does not disintegrate immediately any more than the physical body. The only way it can be disintegrated in the physical body is through cremation or something of that nature. Otherwise, it must slowly decline by decay. The same happens in connection with the energy body. It does not disappear immediately or vanish and fade away. It passes through a kind of death in which it becomes an empty body, a shell from which the soul or the higher nature has departed. This becomes what is known in psychic phenomena as the ghost. This is the part that lingers until it slowly fades away, sometime appear over a period of many years, but it is no longer the person. The person is long gone. The person in the meantime has gone into the emotional sphere of itself, the aura of its field, and here it is having another series of complete experiences. For in each case, the entity passes through a process of birth, growth, maturity, and decline. And in each case, its cycle of life is determined by what it has learned from the lower vehicles or brought down from the higher ones. Gradually, therefore, the entity goes upward through these different worlds, which are often referred to by the ancients as heavens and hells. Hell being nothing more or less than to inherit an etheric or vital body that was no better than the physical one when you were in it. In other words, the physical body was infirm because of abuse. The etheric double is infirm because of abuse or neglect. And in these experiences, the individual passes through rewards and punishments, which, however, are not eternal. They are not in the form of great damnations, but like the experiences of material life are the results of things done and things undone, through which the entity has to gradually grow, extract the essence, and build this into what is called the soul. So all the experiences of an embodiment are precious, they are preserved, they are protected, and they continue. And here also we have the basis of the Akashic records, and the records of actions, and the records of other times, and the records of our planet itself are all preserved in these various strata. Then gradually the individual dies out or fades out of the emotional life. In each case, except the physical, it is a going to sleep. And Hamlet, you know, in the soliloquy, Hamlet says, he's referring to this, that in sleep what dreams may come. In the sleep of death, what dreams may come. This is a very good key that has been generally overlooked. So after that, we go up to, finally, the mental, the mind. And here we have the coordinator who takes everything, or which takes everything, that has been learned and digested and assimilated, and builds it into the full record of an embodiment. In this embodiment, the record is a conscious one from below up, the passing from the body out upward to the higher vehicles is a conscious experience. The descent of the entity from the mental down to the physical is usually experienced in a condition of sleep or unconsciousness. from which the being awakens at the time of birth or shortly before that. Now we know that the birth physically has been preceded by a whole series of previous experiences which do not record as far as the physical world is concerned. But many of these experiences may be available to an entity before physical birth. They're available as factors in the development and consciousness of the entity. So we have, instead of heaven and hell, we have a life cycle. A cycle that goes on to one grade after another until finally it fulfills itself. In other words, a life. We say a lifetime. A lifetime is really a word applicable to the whole cycle. A lifetime is the length of time it takes to pass from the state of unembodiment down through embodiment and back again to unembodiment. This is one lifetime. And this is the period of time in which the alchemy of the transmutation of experience is consistently and continuously going on. And it is this that makes our entire pattern of life real and valuable. Now, we also know that there are other factors that come in. We know that in physical life we dream. And we know that dreams sometimes are very strange things. Dreams sometimes become complete lifetimes. And in many cases you dream of things that could not possibly occur physically. In one quiet night we can dream of a terrible storm in the ocean or the fire that is consuming a whole mountain. We have all kinds of personal experiences of fear and fate, death and life, all in dreams. And these dreams represent a certain amount of karmic dissension within the nature of the person. These dreams are all symbolical of something. They are symbolical of lessons to be learned, things to be understood, things to be worked with, rather than merely something to awaken from and hope and glad that it's over. So all these factors are involved in the problem of the other worlds or the possible understanding of the true life cycle. It begins, however, as a lesson right here. We cannot expect everyone to study this whole pattern and put it together from the dozens and hundreds of records of antiquity in which practically every step of this has been explored by sages and psychics and mystics long before this world, as we know it, came into being even. But we can hope that some understanding of it will help us. Now let's get practical for a moment. This all sounds very theoretical, I know. But let's see what it is to be practical. Here we are on a fairly comfortable planet, fairly nice environment, surrounded by mystery. Now, according to theology, when we die, we will either go to heaven or we will go to hell. Well, on that basis, our problems are rather complicated, and our probabilities are not awfully good. We are very apt to find that we don't really deserve salvation. We haven't done anything to deserve it while we were here. The other situation lies in the fact that if we haven't done something right, that we will go to perdition forever and ever and ever, which is also a very uncomfortable thought. But strangely enough, it has very seldom prevented crime. No matter how much perdition lies ahead, and some of the old artists showed souls roasting in furnaces for 100 million years,